This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We're joined today by State Representative Kate Siegel. She's a Democrat who represents the cities of Battle Creek, Springfield, and Albion in the 62nd District. Along with several townships in Calhoun County, she is in her third term in the Michigan House. Kate Siegel, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined today by Mac McCullough. He's the general manager and executive editor of the Battle Creek Inquirer. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Let's start off with what happened last week with both the Secretary of State and the Michigan Senate, where Ruth Johnson, the Secretary of State, came out with some rules that could eventually lead to more disclosure of donors on so-called issue ads.
Yes.
Ads that don't actually ask you to vote for someone, but may ask you to, say, call Representative Kate Siegel and ask her to XYZ. After she said that this was her proposal to get these rules enacted, which would have taken over a year, the Michigan Senate then moved pretty quickly to nullify those changes. That bill is going to move to the Michigan House. Do you have any idea what may happen in your chamber with that legislation?
You know, I don't. The leadership of the House has been saying they're going to review it, and they have a two-week time period before they could act on it. But I hope there's actual hearings on it. I have to give credit to Secretary of State Johnson for stepping up on this issue. When you think of issue ads back in the day, issue ads were educational. Issue ads were trying to teach a lesson. What issue ads have turned in today is a very targeted message to change your opinion for or against an issue. They are no longer just educational. They are very persuasive, and they're trying to push you in a direction. And people have interest in that. And when you talk about transparency, you should have a right to know who is trying to almost push you to a certain position. That is advocacy. That is trying to change the outcome of an election. And that's what campaign finance is supposed to be. And when you look at Michigan, Michigan has an F from the national ranking groups who look at our transparency in government and our campaign finance. And this bill that the Senate did basically tried to keep the status quo and actually increase the amount of money that influences our elections in the state. And I think it was drastically the wrong move and completely political to do it right after Secretary of State Johnson came out with this initiative.
You say increase the amount of money because it would raise the contribution limits.
Correct. You know, it's already hard to raise money, and it's amazing the amount of money that goes into our elections. And it's something I have to deal with each year. You have to raise money to run. Now, part of that is postage is more expensive than it used to be. We do pay our staffs, in many cases, who, you know, campaign managers, and you have to have a way to communicate to voters. But we're getting to the point where, you know, when it becomes election season, people just want to turn off their televisions. There's so much money in politics that people really are beginning to feel that they have no say as an individual. And that goes against our democracy and goes against what we're trying to do to try to get everybody to vote.
How much of the issue is the amount of money in, and how much of the issue is knowing where it comes from, who's spending it, who's contributing it, and where they're what they're spending it on?
I think it's both. I think when you look at what it takes to win an election and the amount of money involved, people would like to think more of the door-to-doors that we're doing instead of I'm just going to mass mail you and mass call you until you no longer answer your door or answer your phone or turn on your television. And it doesn't encourage the door-to-door, which is one of the cheapest ways you can do that. And that's one of the things I have always done and really enjoy about it. So the more money you get in, the more money you feel like you have to spend. But what's most important is you need to know who has that access and who is influencing, and that should be reported. Now, there was one good thing in the bill, but not enough to vote for it the way it stands. It did require more off-year reporting. Right now, on an off-year, which means we don't have an election, and this year the state and the House are not up. So this entire year, we do not report at all. So we can gather money, and you won't know what people have been doing over this last entire year until January. When the reports are due. So that was one good thing. The rest of it, I think we need to go back and see what's most important, that the people of Michigan should have a right to know, and this bill goes completely against that.
One of the things that can make the whole reporting issue somewhat tricky is how often do you make people report, especially when we're getting close to an election, because people can funnel a lot of money in, say, in the last 2 weeks, and a lot of that we may not know until the election's over. How often can you make someone report legitimately and make sure that we know who's contributing as best we can before we cast ballots?
Well, there's a couple of things that currently happen that I don't think a lot of people know. You can go to a radio station and see what ads are bought. That is public information. But you usually have to drive to the radio station and go and collect that. The other thing is I believe we do a two-week pre-general and pre-primary reports. So we file those. At the state level, those immediately go up online. There is a bill that was part of the package introduced in the Senate that would allow that system for counties and local governments, which I think would be helpful because I know it would be easier for candidates as well to have the automated system. But so you do that 2 weeks prior to an election. And then you think, you know, you got 2 weeks, you can buy a lot of TV in that 2 weeks if you did it right. So you can funnel in a ton of money all of a sudden. While in Michigan, though, you have a 24-hour reporting requirement if you get a big contribution. So anything over $500, you immediately have to report within 24 hours to the Secretary of State. And it's a separate little form. You put it in individually, and then you report it again afterwards. I have not heard from anybody that system has not been working because you can go on every day and see that. You know, you also have to remember you have people running. It is crunch time, and everybody has a lot to do. And I think that 24-hour notice is limited, is reasonable to keep in mind when you get the mail that day. It may come in, and then you have to immediately report that. So that system works. And if it doesn't, I'd love to hear from people on that one. But we do need to have more continuous reporting throughout the years.
Mac?
I wanted to talk a little bit about teacher evaluations. Bridge Magazine has done a great series on setting standards for our teachers, and I know things are a little on hold right now in the legislature. What would you like to see happen there?
I would like to see some more people that are dealing with teachers in a day-in and day-out environment making those decisions. You know, one of the things that we are constantly finding with legislation, especially on education, is we have these best practices. And this happened in the budget last session. And my colleague, who is now vice chair of the Education Committee, Representative Lipton, asked, who created the best practices? And they looked around the room and said, well, I did, and that person did, and that person did. None of them are experts in the field. None of them have ever been in a classroom on the teaching side. And none of them were doing anything that helps the student. It was all based on what teachers are paid, what they're doing outside of the classroom, not what's helping that student. And so that is my concern with teacher evaluations. And I've been talking to a lot of my friends who are teachers. And they are very concerned about that, because they have larger and larger classrooms. They have more and more students. They do not have a support from somebody else in those very large classrooms. And we also have all-inclusive education. So you have all levels in that one classroom. If your child is moved into your grade and they were not up to snuff the year before, and yet you took that student from two levels behind grade level to one level behind grade level in that first testing period, that is never talked about in the quote-unquote reward system for doing a good job. So how are you really balancing what comes into that classroom versus what's going out of that classroom and what that teacher has to work with? So there's always been this blueberry theory out there where everybody wants to run a classroom, not everybody, but they talk about running a classroom like a business. And there's a gentleman doing a huge study to teachers about how to be more efficient in your classroom, how to reach more students. And he made blueberry ice cream. And it's on the internet. You can look up Blueberry Ice Cream Man. And the teacher raised her hand at the end of his presentation and said, so what happens when you get a bad bunch of blueberries? And he just looked at her and said, oh, shoot, you got me, basically. They throw them back. And we do not throw our kids back. We need to do better about helping children that are falling through the cracks. That's why I'm a huge supporter of the Michigan Youth Challenge Academy. That's one avenue. But I also know we need to be looking at class sizes. We need to be looking at how we can help those individuals learn outside of these huge environments where they're coming from different backgrounds, different socioeconomic problems, and different things happening in the home. We don't have the social workers to help with that even I had as a kid, or even a school nurse anymore that can help with some of those basic issues. And so that's what I would like to see, a comprehensive look at what a teacher is doing, what their education is. And we also need to look at continuing education requirements. I have a lot of friends who are teaching, and they spend a lot of time in continuing education courses that they're trying to figure out, how is this supposed to help me get Amanda to read better? Because, you know, it's a generic continuing education course when they could have been spending that time more effectively for the needs of their classroom.
And one of the issues that you didn't bring up is that, you know, through schools of choice, we've written about this extensively, the number of schools that are dealing almost exclusively with low-income children, mm-hmm. and everything they bring into the classroom. How does that work into an evaluation process,
right,
for our teachers?
It's incredibly difficult. You know, we have so many schools now that qualify for free and reduced lunch, and the teachers are telling us our kids are going out, they're going home hungry. You can't teach a kid to love algebra and geometry if they are hungry. And there are those kids out there I know that love geometry and algebra, and they're going to do it no matter what. But you've got to be reacting to that first basic need of that child, and that is a huge problem in our communities. That's Battle Creek, that's Albion, that's Springfield, that's even, you know, in Kalamazoo where we're taping this. It is a problem that we're kind of just brushing aside and blaming one person out of this huge pie.
Is there a good way of separating out? One of the things they say in that Bridge magazine series is that there are a number of factors which are outside the classroom, which are very important in determining how you do in school. The education level of your parents, economics.
The commitment of your parents.
The commitment of your parents, right. You know, income level is very important. But yet, there is also, as they say, pretty good evidence that once you're inside those school walls, the most important thing that's going to determine how you do in school is the quality of teaching. Do we have a good way of separating out yet, you know, how much each of those factors plays into the education of the child, and a good way of measuring it? Have we found that?
I don't think so, because if we had found that, we'd probably... Hopefully somebody would be promoting it in the hearings, regardless of whether they were being listened to. But I think from some of the reports I have listened to, and I don't sit on the education committee, so I'm not hearing all of the details of the testimony and the reports. But, you know, this is a increasing problem nationwide as well. We just happen to not be doing well in Michigan. And we've got a lot of struggles going on, and we need to be more supportive of our teachers and finding out how to make them better teachers rather than telling them they're bad teachers and how to fix that. We're not talking about how we make them better. We're talking about, well, what do we have to do? The language coming out of Lansing is very detrimental to the teachers that we do have, and they are leaving the profession. And we have young people who we are saying on one side we want young people and the smartest to come into the profession, and yet we are treating this profession terribly in how we approach it and talk about it. So that's not helping our future either. We're not even going to be getting those students that we want in the classrooms with the language and how that profession's being treated right now.
We published an editorial a few weeks ago about the lack of teachers of color in our schools. And there is some research out there that indicates that the high level of teacher turnover attributed to some of the things you just mentioned, but also the idea that teaching to the test gives teachers a lot less autonomy to run their classrooms. What do you think the impact of the implementation of Common Core is going to be in the state?
Well, I look at Common Core differently than it teaching to the test in the sense of, you know, I had friends that moved around a lot, and I moved from one school system to another in high school, and the education drastically was different. And you kind of do a lot of catch up. So the idea would be that you have concepts being taught at the same level, the same grade across the state. But the idea has gotten pushed so hard into you have to teach this on this day of this, which is not a concept, which is not where you want to be. And when we talk about how do you reach students and how do you be a better teacher, it's finding out who that kid is and what interests them. I was very lucky. I have a slew of teachers who made me fall in love with all sorts of subjects. And I remember my history teacher in particular, we spent a lot of time almost doing role plays of American history to really make it come to life. And I remember those lessons now today, many, many, many years later because of that. So you need to have that flexibility. There's a way to teach, you know, the Industrial Revolution, if we're talking about American history, and have that core concept taken care of, but allowing the teacher a different ways to teach those core concepts in the classroom. There's a big story on NPR of a national education program used in Africa and the Middle East that teaches on a tablet, puts the curriculum together, and then hires a teacher-ish type person to deliver the exact message they did. That is not where we want to go. But having the basic concepts, so if you are in third grade in Michigan and you end up having to move or you sit to get down with another third grader, you kind of know what's going on, I think that's a good thing for stabilizing our children's education.
You mentioned you're not on the education committee. But you are on the insurance committee.
Yes, I'm the vice chair of the House Insurance Committee.
And the issue of reforming Michigan's no-fault insurance system has come up a few times. It seems to die down for a while, and then there's more talk that maybe it needs to be revisited. You came out pretty strongly against what the governor had proposed back in the summer or the spring. Are there reforms that you would want to make to the system if you could wave a magic wand or if it was up to you?
If I could wave a magic wand, I would have the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association open their books so we can see what the problem is. There's all this talk about how we reduce rates, and rates are too high in Michigan. I have to pay auto insurance just like everybody else. I know how high they are. The problem is, are we fixing a problem or making it worse? Because what we don't know is what that problem is. We are being told that the fund that cares for us if we're in a catastrophic accident is driving up our rates and it's too expensive and it's going to go bankrupt. So show us the numbers. They have $17 billion with a B in reserves. And we were told in the insurance committee that that numbers, they'd like to say, well, we're in a deficit. We don't have enough money to pay the claims. But when asked how come our assessments keep going up that we all pay per car right now, they raised it to 186 after this legislation didn't pass. They say that that's not included in their projections. How do you not include money that you are guaranteed to collect every year? And by law, they can assess this and collect it, that is not included in the funds and the money that they say we're short. So show me the numbers. Right now, my fear is that Michiganders will lose a benefit that would put any parent at ease if their child got hit in a car accident, that they would actually be able to be taken care of. And saying that we're going to save money without any proof, without any guarantee, and without any backup to that. And the other interesting thing is you want to talk about auto insurance rates. For some odd reason, we never can get them to talk about their collision rates. And the fact if you get in a car accident, you have to go to this place to get your car done with these parts and this way. In many states, collision is separated from the health care benefit, and they will not talk about that side of the high costs in Michigan. If you want to talk about some of the Detroit rates with the fact that cars are stolen a lot, that's on the collision side. Why aren't we talking about the full picture of auto insurance?
Now, Michigan has a unique system.
Yes.
Compared to other states. No other state has this. So I guess I'm wondering, is there something different about Michigan that requires us to have a very different system than the other 49 states, or do we just have a better system than everybody else has?
A little bit of both, because if you think about it, the system was started back in the 70s, and so we have built up that reserve, and that's one of the problems with the legislation right now is they want to take the reserve for themselves. In fact, the original version of the bill paid the insurance company back our money. Had a big problem with that. It should have gone back to the consumers and then start a new fund. Well, starting a new fund right off the bat and could have had one catastrophic accident, our assessments would go through the roof because there's not a reserve there. So this started back in the 70s, which is why I think Michigan can keep this system and why we have $17 billion in reserves. In another state, trying to start a program like this would be very difficult. The other thing you have to look at is recently, it might be a year ago now, Michigan was rewarded 4 contracts from the National Military and Veterans Affairs Division for brain injury and post-traumatic stress syndrome cases for our veterans and returning men and women from serving. 4 of them came to Michigan out of, I think it was 20 or less, maybe 24 or less. The fact that Michigan is recognized repeatedly for the spinal cord injury work we do, for the brain injury work we do, and that leads into the post-traumatic stress also, is because of the system we have. We are having experts in the fields that are available to treat our people in the state because of that. And we continue to be on the cutting edge of those types of diseases. And if you look at the MCCA, the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, is a separate assessment. That's your $186. This is after your insurance pays for the $500,000. And then for $186, if we're looking at that, if you got in a car accident today and your child was in the car, they are covered for their life, for the things that happened in that accident. Unfortunately, my husband and daughter are involved in a rear-end accident. They got somebody smashed into the back of them. They were fine. But I will tell you that split second when I heard they were in an accident before the words, "we're fine," came out, was very thankful that we have that system in place. And until they show me that this is a problem, that we cannot afford it, and they cannot willy-nilly raise our rates when they don't get their way in Lansing, I will continue to fight for that benefit.
Mac?
A bill that went through the Senate last week, it was divisive, but not along party lines, and that was to expand the role of advanced practice nurses. Mm-hmm. What do you expect to happen in the House with that bill?
I also think it's going to be very divisive in the House. One of the things we need to find out is a lot of amendments added to that bill Thursday morning and on the floor. And we are still trying to get the final language of what those amendments were, because there is a belief that one of the last amendments that got on kind of gutted the bill. But what this would do would be allow nurse practitioners to practice in Michigan to the full extent of their training. There is a huge difference of opinion between nurse practitioners and physicians on this issue, because physicians believe if you want to diagnose and practice without a physician oversight, you should become a physician. Nurse practitioners believe that they have a way of doing some of that same training, because they do pharmaceutical, they do the diagnosis testing, and they have to have over a master's level, boards, clinicals, et cetera, that they are able to do that primary care role. And it would be very primary care, and still would have to refer to a physician in certain circumstances. Most other states have practicing nurse practitioners can do this. So this is going to continue to be a big issue. I am curious to see what committee it goes to. Committees on some of these controversial issues, you would think it would go to health policy, which I also sit on, but you would have thought Medicaid expansion would have gone to health policy, and it did not. So looking to see what committee this goes to. You know, I have a friend that just received her nurse practitioner license last month. And when you look at the Family Health Center of Battle Creek and the work that they are trying to do with creating access to preventative and primary care, they really do rely on nurse practitioners. And with more people hopefully being able to gain access to insurance and those wellness visits that come with that, that we will have more providers able to do that.
And that's a lot of the clientele for the nurse practitioners are underserved populations.
Correct. And that's where they specialize. And in areas that don't can't afford a physician or don't have enough of the referrals or the clientele base to support a physician.
Now, the troubling amendment that you think might have gutted the bill, that has to do with malpractice insurance?
I believe so, because I don't think it's offered. So basically, you can claim, and I'm not sure of all the specifics. I've been trying to get the language off. It takes a while, especially on the last day of session, to get everything updated on what was happening on the internet. But if they made an insurance requirement that's not offered in Michigan, that would gut the bill pretty quickly.
What does the data say about patient safety in those 17 states that have expanded nurse practitioners?
I have not heard of any cases where nurse practitioners have a higher lawsuit rate or outcomes that are different in that. And that's one of the things we will be seeing in the House is another full set of hearings on this. I don't believe this will be one of those bills that, you know, very quickly goes through the House. I think there'll be ample opportunity for both sides to present their issues. But I also have two family members who are nurse practitioners in other states, and they've never had any problems and provide excellent care.
I want to ask you about government consolidation. There was the vote earlier this month in Saugatuck and Douglas, which was rejected by the voters there to possibly combine those two cities. Of course, whenever there is a proposal that comes up, people note it doesn't happen very often in Michigan that two governments do consolidate, but Battle Creek and Battle Creek Township is one of the few examples where it did pass. Is it a good idea, and should the state continue to pursue it, or is it putting the incentive out there just kind of a waste of time and resources because the voters, for the most part, seem to have decided that they like whatever local government they have?
It depends on why it's done. A lot of the consolidation talk that has been happening in the last couple of years, in my opinion, is due to lack of funding. And so we're going to continue cutting funding to local governments and local schools and local units, and then force consolidation and force the hand to force that consolidation. That always is not in the best interest of the public and the constituencies. And, you know, you have to look at the circumstances that went around Battle Creek Township and Battle Creek City combined. declining. There was a lot of more influence than just two communities sitting there. There was a very large influence of a large employer in the area on that. I was not here at the time, so I don't know all the details, but I've heard about it over the years. I'm sure there'll be a book written on it someday.
Kellogg is the large employer. Yeah. Question, in case anyone was wondering.
So there was reasons for it at that time. And you have to look at that. But what is the gain in services? What is the gain of the communities to do that? And you also have to remember, communities are the lifeblood of a lot of people. And I represent Springfield. Springfield is a very small, surrounded by Battle Creek, but they are very proud of their Springfield traditions, and they want to be Springfield. But at the same time, they're now consolidating their public services. They work in conjunction with the city of Battle Creek and surrounding areas. They have joined and partnered, but they still have that community identity. And so what is our goal for consolidation? Are we trying to get rid of the names of communities, the name of school buildings, or are we really trying to find a better way to deliver a better service for the less money?
The jury may still be out, but what we've done in Calhoun County with Jackson County on roads is an example of combining resources.
Correct. And having some more money instead of the overhead, yes. And again, it will be interesting to see how that works out in the long run. Is it the current economy that will make that good, and will we keep that even when things, you know, hopefully get better and we find some road funding? There are good things that happen that you can do without forcing the consolidation and the loss of a government entity.
When we talk about consolidation, though, some people are going to look at what happened with Albion and Marshall. Mm-hmm. And I guess, would it be better that there is some sort of thought-out process of this rather than, oh, boy, we've got to close a high school because we're at the end of our rope funding-wise, and sort of an emergency marriage, I guess, of two schools going into one high school? I mean, would it be better that there is some sort of a plan in advance of that rather than just what sort of happens when one school district runs out of money to maintain a high school?
Well, definitely. And that is one of the big concerns. We have over 50 schools, I think over 60 now, on the brink of running out of funding, and that is continuing to grow. And that is not the system we want to have. We have lost $2 billion in our school aid fund. It is hurting our universities significantly. We now are one of the most expensive states in the country to send our kids to a public university in Michigan, and it starts at our elementary schools. And that goes back to the, you know, earlier when we were talking about best practices. It is more expensive to educate a high school student. They need more classes, more varies. They need the labs, et cetera, to meet the standards for graduation. But at the same time, community schools lead to community sense of pride, the support system for the schools, and that needs to be balanced. And the other thing, you know, when we look at Battle Creek, that's always the talk. We have those five schools, five administrative teams, five superintendents who are all great, and I love working with all of them. That is a different conversation than shutting down a school and then we start busing students. And, you know, I know Albion and Marshall have worked very tightly together to work on this, to make it work. And I hope it continues to work. But I think we need to look long term of what we want an education system to look like and have those plans in place. Is it better to have regional high schools? Is it better to do smaller and here and money there? But you start getting very concerned, especially in the rural areas of Michigan that you have to look at public policy for. If kids are on the bus for over 2 hours one way each day, where is their quality of life and their rural education? And so we have to look at that statewide as well as locally.
Well, and you look at the Albion situation, and this is not a comment on how well they're doing with the consolidation of the two schools, but the community certainly feels left behind, and that was very much evident in the millage that was on the ballot. How do you, and again, you know, other communities, they want to hang on to that identity. How do you bring a community along in those conversations?
Well, and it's difficult because there is a long history between Marshall and Albion. There is a very long history of the communities being very divided. And you have a very low-income group in Albion as well that, you know, you've now put the school and their students' education farther away from them. And in many cases, a lot of the families in Albion do not have the private transportation to get to Marshall. And one of the things about Albion is they're very supportive of their school. schools. A lot of Albion Pride, a lot of people throughout the community, whether or not they're in school or not, wear red on Fridays for the Albion school systems and go to the games and things like that. And so we need to figure out, beyond getting the kids the education, of how can we bridge those gaps to really allow both communities to work together, regardless of past and history, but do what's best for those kids and make sure those kids are supported.
All right, we're down to just about the end of our time with you here. So you are in your last term in the Michigan House, as allowed under the current state constitution.
Yes.
Have you decided what you might be doing? Would you have any plans to run for elected office in the future?
Well, that is the weird thing about term limits, is we now have a group of legislators that are sitting there and everybody wants to know what we're doing next. But I have a very big job, and that is what I get up every morning for. And I am trying to make sure I'm concentrating on what I am in Lansing to do now for my community and not get hung up on what's next. But I love my community. I love the honor they placed in me to be representative, and I am going to keep doing that to the best of my ability as long as they'll have me.
Would you say that a run for elected office in the future is possible?
I'm 38, of course.
Well, some people get tired of a job after they've had it for 5 or 6 years.
You know, it is a different time than when I graduated from college and started, talking about politics and working in the world. It's very, very different. There's a lack of compromise in many areas. I never thought I would see the day when the Michigan Capitol was closed or to the public during debate, or the public would vote down a public law and have it turned around and repassed with just 4 changes, which we saw happen in the emergency of financial manager law. Those things have to stop and they have to change. And I will always continue to be an advocate to make sure those types of things don't happen.
Do those sort of things happening make you want to stay and continue to work on the other side, or do they make you tired of the process?
I still get up every morning ready to go. So, there are days that is a struggle because of that. But there are days where great things happen and we can do good things. And so you keep working for those days and keep fighting against the others.
Kate Siegel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
State Representative Kate Siegel, who represents Battle Creek and other parts of Calhoun County in the Michigan House. And thanks again to Mac McCullough, the General Manager and Executive Editor of the Battle Creek Inquirer. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.